shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Red.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Red.
Please, please don't shoot me down. My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down. And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. It's living free, boys don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please,
please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
Well, that was Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and the song was Ruby Ridge, and on his Bluegrass Conspiracies album. And this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. It's 49 degrees. Yes, it is. I was looking at the inside. It's 49 degrees. And tonight I have this is Truth Quest. And, I'm going to say that the disclaimer is, and they moved it here. The views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my co-host is with me tonight, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and I have a repeat guest here that we had was on our very first show, and he's back. This is James Fetzer from Pasadena, California. And at graduation from South Pasadena High School in 1958, he was presented with the Carver Award for Leadership. He was magna cum laude in philosophy at Princeton University in 1962, where his senior thesis for Carl G. Hempel on the logical structure of explanations of human behavior won the Dickinson Prize. After being commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps, he became an artillery officer and served in the Far East. After a tour supervising recruit training in San Diego, he resigned his commission as captain and began graduate work in the history and philosophy of science at Indiana in 1966. He completed his PhD with a dissertation on probability and explanation for Wesley C. Salmon in 1970. His initial faculty appointment was at the University of Kentucky, where he received the first Distinguished Teaching Award presented by the student government to one of 135 assistant professors. Since 1977, he has taught at a wide range of institutions of higher learning, including the Universities of Virginia twice, Cincinnati, North Carolina at Chapel Hill, New College of the University of South Florida, and now the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota, where he served from 1987 until his retirement in 2006. His honors include a research fellowship from the National Science Foundation and the Medal of the University of Helsinki. In 1996, he became one of the first 10 faculty at the University of Minnesota to be appointed a Distinguished McKnight University Professor. He's published more than 100 articles and reviews and 20 books in the philosophy of science and on the theoretical foundations of computer science, artificial intelligence, and cognitive science. So, good evening, Eric. I heard you reading that on somebody I was listening to today, so I thought maybe you'd appreciate appreciate that, Jim.
That was a marathon.
Very impressive.
Oh my God, how many
lives have you led? The salient thing here we need to add, Melody, is that Dr. James Fetzer is founder of the Scholars for 911 Truth, and he has also done a lot of research on, he's got a book out on that topic, and it's called The 911 Conspiracy. He's also written at least one, I'm not sure, maybe more than one book on the JFK assassination.
I've edited three on JFK.
Okay,
yeah, so I guess I lost steam there towards the end, but some you didn't have the 9/11 on there. I didn't see it.
No, not in that bio sketch that appears on my academic website. If you did a Google search and just put in my name, Jim Fetzer, that's what would pop up, and that's, of course, where you found it.
And, of course, the interview we had with you last August was very informative. It was mostly on the subject of 9/11. And some of the state of the art in terms of the 911 truth movement and the conference that you had just hosted in Madison in August of 2007. And we also broke into the topic of the assassination of Kennedy. So hopefully we can update some of these ideas now because it's been, 7 or 8 months.
And
get your impressions about perhaps what's new in the with Scholars for 911 Truth and the movement. Has your thinking evolved since we talked last, or is it still a matter of just trying to get these ideas out and heard and sifted through kind of more and more individuals?
Yeah, I don't think our theoretical understanding of the case has changed much, nor has the evidence been subjected to significant alteration, although there's an interesting development just today, which is that there's a society of engineers that has broken into conflict among its own members over whether the, let me pull this up, this, I think the American Society of Civil Engineers has got an internal dispute over whether they did an adequate job of investigating the World Trade Center, and this could actually be a great advance in the sense that it would get some serious people looking at these issues, because, of course, the official government account violates laws of physics and laws of engineering. So if you have somebody who understands their discipline, it's going to take them no time at all to determine that the government account is a crock. And so I'm real happy with this particular development just being reported today. Now, in other ways, probably the most significant development has been, of recent times, has been the proliferation of multiple more specialized groups than scholars. When I founded Scholars, it was the only research society for studying 9/11. But since then, we've had the development of the pilots for 9/11 truth, architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, even a student scholars for 9/11 truth. And they're doing a lot of good work. Now, if you went to the Scholars website at 911scholars.org, in the upper right-hand corner, you'd see an icon entitled Patriots Question 9/11. And if you go there, you'll find another remarkable development, which you got in excess of 1,000 experts in different fields. I mean, you got over 130 senior military intelligence, law enforcement, and government officials. You got more than 360 engineers and architects, over 100 pilots and aviation professionals, over 230 professors, over 200 9/11 survivors and family members, over 130 artists, entertainers, and media. But what we got here is over 1,000 experts distributed across these different fields. And what you can do here, and this is utterly fascinating, I mean, start scrolling down. I mean, the first U.S. military officer is General Wesley Clark, former Supreme Commander of the NATO forces, for example. And General Albert Stubblebine, who is a the leading expert in the world on analyzing photographs, who concluded that that in fact the record at the Pentagon showed no plane had hit the Pentagon, that a big plane hadn't hit the Pentagon, and it just goes on and on and on. It's really quite fascinating. So I encourage, you know, everyone, if they want to, you know, be heartened about what's going on here, to take a look at this pilot's question, Patriot's question, 9/11. It's also the case that just today, poll results were released that showed that about 10% of the public believes that the government brought about 9/11, and that another 32.5% believe that the government let it happen. So that you got like 42.5% of the population that's committed to the government being heavily complicit in 9/11. And of the remainder, there's some 27% that doesn't even think that the Bush administration took advantage of 9/11. So these are people who obviously are clearly uninformed. And if you subtract them from the 57% on the other side, then you get 30% who really, you know, are inclined to believe the government, that aren't just, you know, kind of ideological fanatics, which means you got more disbelievers than believers. That seems to me to be quite a striking development.
Yeah, and I can remember from the paper that I wrote myself, which is called 911 was an inside job and a psyop, which is also on the Patriots Question 911 website, that when I wrote that, which was the fall of 2006, there had been a poll that was just done that said 36% of the American people thought the government was involved, and we've now, I guess, moved up to 42% in this.
Yeah.
So in that, you know, year and a half or so, more people are coming over to this very skeptical position. Yeah.
Well, and I continue to be invited to speak here and there. There are a couple of conferences forthcoming that you can find on the 9/11 Scholars website. If you go to events, most recently, just a couple weeks ago, I was in New Haven and gave two talks at Yale, one on JFK and one on 9/11. And those were on Tuesday and Thursday. And meanwhile, Wednesday, I went up to Keene, New Hampshire, where the student scholars, and their home base is Franklin Pierce College, where Justin Martell, the founder, is a student, had arranged for me to speak at the public library. And we had about 70 citizens there who were extremely knowledgeable. They had, in fact, had a... over the past years had a series of rather prominent members of the 9/11 community, including William Rodriguez, for example, Michael Berger, others there Richard Gage. So these guys were really sophisticated and really knowledgeable. And what was most interesting about it to me, and I wouldn't really discover this until the next day, was there was one fellow who was raising a question about a point I was making about the color of molten metal, whether it could be aluminum or had to be iron and so forth. And he was challenging a point I was making that actually a student of Judy Wood had been researching before he was murdered in Minneapolis, a fellow named Michael Zieber. And I thought, well, of all, you know, everyone there, most of whom were really warmly appreciative of what I was saying, I really felt comfortable with this group because they were so knowledgeable. I felt, well, he was the lone dissident. And then the next day, when I was visiting a store called the Hemporium that's really devoted to all the benefits of hemp as a miracle product, you know, one of nature's miracle products for using, making clothing and rope and all kinds of stuff. Even you can make a kind of paper out of hemp. It's astonishing how versatile this product is, and it's different. Hemp is different than the variation that happens to be the smokable product, which is, you know, marijuana. It's a fascinating situation that the owner of the shop, who had also come to the conference, had an email there that was long and detailed. I mean, it was like two solid pages, single space. I mean, it must have been, oh my goodness, it must have been at least 1,000, maybe 1,200 words long. And it was a very detailed message that had been sent to the representative for their district explaining in minute detail all the information that I'd presented the night before, and insisting that this really justified an investigation into 9/11, and it was authored by the fellow who'd raised the question that I thought was the dissenter.
Well, that's great, and then that leads into my next question, Jim, which is what is the chance? I guess two questions. What is the chance that this country is moving towards some kind of an independent investigation? Because this is what all the patriots who are questioning 911 are calling for. Is there any movement on that front?
Well, see, I think right now the whole country is kind of fascinated and absorbed by the political competition, particularly on the Democratic side, where you have the former First Lady out to kneecap her opponent in the Democratic Party and praising the Republican candidate as more qualified than Obama. It's the most bizarre developments in my lifetime politically. And I must say, you know, in my judgment, Hillary Clinton, who is really basically trying to blackmail the Democratic Party to choose between having her as the candidate and certain defeat, which she's going to contribute to, for example, by talking endlessly about Florida and Michigan and how the party is disenfranchising these people and how that's un-American, undemocratic, laying out a kind of program for the Republicans to run on, no matter how unqualified their candidate. And she continues to praise John McCain as having met the threshold for the commander-in-chief test, as she has met the threshold for the commander-in-chief test. But Barack Obama, she says, has a speech, and then you got Bill Clinton out there, and Bill Clinton is saying, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if two individuals who love their country, who'd done all this service, who really cared about America, were to be competing against one another, and how Hillary has great affection for John McCain, and how, you know, you'd have a great opportunity to discuss the issues instead of all this other stuff that gets involved in it. And of course, all the other stuff has everything to do with Barack Obama, who, in my opinion, is one of the most dazzling candidates I've ever seen. I mean, he, not only is he rhetorically gifted, extremely well-educated, he's got an excellent mind, he's a very astute manager of his own campaign. I mean, if you just were to judge the difference between Hillary and Barack on the basis of the way they manage their campaign, Hillary had this massive presumption she was going to prevail. She had a huge amount of support going in. Then she mismanaged everything, lost Iowa right off the bat. She spent all her money up front. So by the time Super Tuesday was passed, she was basically broke. She's had to throw $5 million of her own bucks into the campaign. And she's had to take this extremely low road to try to resurrect the situation when he, her opponent, has more delegates, has won more states, and has won, you know, more of the popular vote than has she, so that the kitchen sink strategy really turns out to be the Tonya Harding approach. It's really stunning and disgusting. I mean, Obama has been better organized. He's had his troops on the ground. They've been more thorough, more professional. They've made more money in January. He set a record, principally by benefiting through the Internet, of $35 million raised in a single month, and then in February, $55 million, the most any presidential candidate. I mean, if you just compare them based on the way they've run their campaign, one has been utterly incompetent and the other has been quite brilliant. Not only that, but of course this guy John McCain, for Hillary to be comparing herself to John McCain is bizarre. John McCain was just being discussed tonight on Keith Olbermann's show Countdown, one of the best programs on television, if you aren't, you know, if anyone has ever missed it. Well, he's saying how McCain has repeatedly over the last year or so said on four or more different occasions he doesn't know anything about economics. That he really wishes he knew something about economics. And of course, we're in a situation where the economic situation for the country is a complete total mess. He's over in Iraq and he's talking about how the Iranians are taking Al-Qaeda into Iran and training them and sending them back, and he has to have Joe Lieberman there to whisper in his ear and tell him, no, that's wrong, because Al-Qaeda is Sunni and the Iranians are Shias, and they wouldn't bring the Sunnis in. So what's going on is the Iranians are actually training extremists, but not Al-Qaeda. He corrects himself, but he said the same thing falsely the day before, and he says the same thing falsely several times after that. I mean, it's bizarre. He's also claimed that the Constitution made this into a Christian nation. So I printed it out. It's not that long. You can read it in about 15 or 20 minutes. There's not a word about God. There's not a word about Christianity. In fact, it very explicitly states that there'll be no religious test for public office. So it seems to me this guy is completely and totally unfit to be president of the United States or even commander-in-chief. He's talking about staying in Iraq for 100 years. And if we're successful in the surge, we got to stay. And if we're unsuccessful in the surge, we got to stay. I mean, it's bizarre. So Hillary, in my opinion, has coupled herself to John McCain, and they're going to rise or fall together. I think they've both discredited themselves on so many grounds. It's truly astounding.
That's a nice update on the political situation here. But in terms of the independent investigation, would you say for 911? Would you say that we'd have to wait until and see if there's somebody in the White House in a year or two that is willing to take that on. Or
in all probability, I mean, you know,
go to completely independent international body or something like that.
There have been various developments abroad. For example, you know, there was this Japanese prime minister who raised 9/11 in the Japanese parliament as an issue. That's, of course, a very, very significant development. And the former premier of Italy has said that 9/11 was obviously an inside job. And there's going to be some major conference in Europe, though exactly where now momentarily eludes me. But I do think, yeah, that the international community has not been taken in the way that we have here in the United States, principally because their media is not dominated by corporate and governmental interests that deprive us of the most significant news of the day. I mean, it's really stunning, but there it is.
Yeah. Well, okay, so in terms of what's happening here, is there another 911 truth conference coming up that people should know about or could know about?
Well, there's going to be a conference on conspiracies in general out in California. Let me give you the name of that. It's called 7 to 8 June in Santa Clara, California. There's a conspiracy conference 2008. Jim Mars is going to be out there talking about JFK. I'm going to be out there talking about 9/11. But there's going to be a lot of others. That could be extremely interesting if you're anywhere in that vicinity. Otherwise, there are a couple of things coming up. On April 15th, there's this Granny Warriors conference that is in part in honor of Ron Paul. That's going to be held on the west lawn of the Capitol. This is right in front of the Capitol building, and it's called the Taking Back Our Freedoms Rally, and I've been invited to come and talk about 9/11. So
okay,
I'll be doing that there in front of the Capitol on that occasion, and I hope to make a couple of rather significant points.
Yeah. Well, you know, Alfred Weber, I guess I should say to our listeners that Jim's book is called The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, but he's also put out a DVD called The Science and Politics of 9/11, which has now been produced into a 14-hour DVD by Sophia of 9/11, who has a website, www.911weknow.com. And I sat through those 14 hours and found that to be very, very useful. I had actually been sorry to miss that conference in Madison in August last year, but with that video, I was able to catch up, I think, and see the highlights of that. And I just mentioned that one of the speakers there, a guy named international lawyer by the name of Alfred Weber, is talking about. He actually thinks he knows who the conspirators are, and he gives them a name, and he calls them something like the International War Crimes Racketeering Syndicate or Organization, and mentions that there is a proposed Citizens War Crimes Tribunal to be established under the jurisdiction of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal. I was just wondering if you've heard anything more, whether that has come to pass.
Well, I know that he and Lauren Moray, who also spoke at the conference, who's an expert on depleted uranium, among other topics, have been working on that. But, you know, it reminds me that I really ought to have one or both of them on this radio show I do three times a week, which is called The Dynamic Duo. On Genesis Communications Network, where Kevin Barrett and I divide responsibilities. Kevin's there on Monday and Friday, and I'm Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, from 5 to 7 Eastern Time, 4 to 6 Central, which I take it would be 3 to 5 Mountain Time. So, it's a great show because we deal with very controversial topics. And what I ought to do, Eric, to follow up on your question, is have Alfred Weber and/or Lauren Moray on the show to give us an update.
Yeah, that would be great. Those two are both very impressive speakers. It seems like the cast of characters in your August conference last year was very impressive indeed. I guess we could just jump into some of the specifics. You know, some of these interviews that are on your are also on your website, 911scholars.org. So if people want to hear some of these interviews that Jim has had recently with the dynamic duo, they can go right to his website and listen there. I listened to one of those recently, and we might as well start out with this, Jim, if you don't mind. And you were interviewing Dr. Judy Wood, who is a, I think, one of the real seminal investigators of what happened to the Twin Towers and all of the World Trade Center. She's a mechanical engineering professor. But also you had another character by the name of John Hutchison, known for the Hutchison effect. And if I could, I'll just briefly summarize, and then you can add your sense of it. Judy Wood has come up with assembled, I think, the most complete set of photographs that are available for the destruction of the World Trade Center, and she's analyzed them very, very carefully. She knows what's where, and she says that we should not look at 9/11 as another new Pearl Harbor. We should look at it as another Hiroshima. She said it was more like complete devastation. The area was fuming for weeks and weeks afterwards. The buildings themselves were dustified, pulverized. The amount of rubble of the World Trade Center 1 and 2 is, there's virtually very little rubble, not nearly as much as you'd expect, because the material itself was almost vaporized, you might say, molecular dissociation, things like this. And she's come up with the hypothesis that this might have been done by some kind of directed energy weapon, Star Wars, HARP, something like that. And she's looked around the world for examples and found a guy up in British Columbia named John Hutchison, who is has been experimenting in a laboratory for quite a while, I guess, and come up with some very bizarre effects, a la the great inventor, perhaps Nikola Tesla, of 100 years ago. And anyway, so you had these two on the show. Could you give us your impressions about whether Judy Wood's work is holding up, you think, and also whether John Hutchison has added much to the debate?
Well, it's a very curious situation, Eric, that you raise. The day before, I'd had Ace Baker on. Ace, in my opinion, is completely brilliant. He's a composer, a musician, an expert in digital processing, and he's produced some of the most fascinating studies of video fakery on 9/11, especially in relation to the videos of the planes hitting the building, where I think, based on his work, there can be no doubt that the principal videos that we saw on 9/11 or have seen since have been faked. Now, the possibility that the films are faked doesn't necessarily mean that no planes actually hit the buildings, which most Americans find extremely difficult to even imagine. But it does raise the possibility that either there were no planes or there were features of the planes and the way they impacted with the building that needed to be concealed. It turns out that there was a 17-second delay between the time of the alleged events took place and the time they were actually broadcast, which would have allowed the opportunity to do considerable amount of manipulation with previously prepared footage. Now, my judgment is that Ace Baker, and he has a website at acebaker.com, has actually just taken apart the official account in terms of its visual properties. I mean, some of it, you, of course, saw a presentation he gave that ran several hours that was given at the August conference here in Madison, and that's on the DVD, which, of course, runs 14 hours. I mean, this is really quite a compilation. And were you happy with the quality of the visual images and so forth and in general? That for, you know, we didn't have the resources to hire professionals, so we had a couple of non-professionals who were recording and then editing for us. But did you feel the content was there?
The content was definitely there. I have a couple little minor concerns, but in general I learned an awful lot. There's a couple places in there where all of a sudden the sound disappears. And Judy Wood does not get her own box. All the other speakers get their box. You know, now we're going to have Ace Baker speak. Now we're going to have Jim Fetzer speak. And I had to kind of search for Judy Wood, which was the one that I was really wanting to see.
Well, you're talking about on the menu bar? No, I'm sure it's there, Eric. Go back and take another look. You know, because I mean, I introduced every speaker. Now remember, see, there were two parts to Judy.
Judy gave a presentation, and then we had Bob Petrakis give a presentation. Then we brought back Judy, and then we had Jerry Liepart, who's this activist attorney from Connecticut. And that's some fascinating stuff. That might be, you know, for many who are relatively new to this, that will probably be the most interesting sequence of them all, those four sessions. But I think if you do a double check, no, I think the boxes are below. The menu isn't complete on one image on the screen, Eric. You got there's an arrow, a down arrow to go for the rest of the images. So they're actually all there. You just
I've got kind of an old DVD unit. So
okay.
In fact,
well, what I'm saying,
Jerry, I didn't see that, but I'll go back and see if I can find
it. Well, they are all there. I can assure you now. On Sunday, the conference was Saturday and Sunday. Morgan Reynolds, a former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, who is a longtime Republican. He's published six books on economics and has now turned out to be one of the most outspoken critics of the Bush administration in relation to 9/11, gave a preliminary discussion of multiple forms of evidence that raised problems about the planes, and there are problems about the planes at all locations. I mean, just to mention a couple points in general, each of those planes has hundreds or even thousands of time-sensitive, uniquely identifiable parts that have to be replaced periodically for safety reasons. And yet, from none of the four locations, alleged crash locations, was even one of these uniquely identifiable component parts ever discovered. Moreover, I have the FAA records that show two of the planes were only deregistered in 2002 and the other two not until 2005, which is quite bizarre if those planes actually were destroyed on 9/11. And of course there's a huge amount of other considerations that go along with this, such as that, as David Ray Griffin observed in as the very first point in his book on the 9/11 Commission Report Omissions and Distortions, half a dozen or more of these alleged hijackers have turned up alive and well and living in the Middle East. So, you know, they can't have been killed in impacts of these planes with these buildings or with the ground and yet be alive and well living in the Middle East. And, of course, every aspect about the hijackers, they weren't competent to fly the planes. Hani Hanjour, his instructor, said he really couldn't fly at all. For him to have performed this seeming astounding flying feat in relation to bringing Flight 77 into the Pentagon is really quite preposterous. In fact, that plane actually goes off of the radar in the Kentucky-Ohio border, and there's only an interpolation, you know, a series of broken lines to show an imaginary trajectory back to Washington where there is a separate, a much smaller plane appears to have been substituted. We could, of course, talk about that in depth, but the point I'm making is we really don't have proof of these planes. It's quite bizarre. At the Pentagon, you know, the hit point is actually right on the ground floor. It's only about 10 feet high and 16 or 17 feet wide, and yet you have unbroken windows in the vicinity. You have a fence. You have automobiles. What you don't have is a massive pile of debris from an airliner that weighs 100 tons. Even though it's got a limestone facade, you don't have any imprint of the wings, which are 125 feet wide. I mean, look, this is a 757 where the 767s that hit the Trade Center went through steel and concrete and create these huge cookie-cutter-like cutouts in steel and concrete. Well, if that were true of steel and concrete, then it should certainly be true of this limestone, even if it's a reinforced part of the building. I mean, and you don't have anything. You don't have the pile of debris. You don't have the wings. You don't have the seats, the bodies, the luggage. Airliners have a reputation for losing your luggage, but this is absurd. You don't have the tail. Tails are structurally, in terms of its component, the way it is designed, is one of the strongest parts of a plane. You don't have the tail. In fact, the engines were never even recovered. This is stupefying. Not only that, but the plane allegedly flew over 500 miles an hour, just barely skimming the ground. Well, this turns out to be aerodynamically impossible. Aeronautical engineers have explained to me that, you know, these planes in flight accumulate a pocket of compressed gas beneath the fuselage, that gas being air, and that even a little Cessna at full throttle couldn't get closer than 15 feet to the ground. They told me that a plane like a 757 couldn't get closer than 60 feet to the ground. Plus, it would have.
And then it would have to go much slower. Yeah.
To get to the ground, it would have to go much slower, which is the only way these planes can actually land at airports, is because they slow down so dramatically. So you can't. It's physically impossible to have a plane flying that fast, that low to the ground. And yet, if it isn't flying, you know, that low to the ground, it can't have hit on the ground floor. In fact, the engines hang down on that thing, and they would have been plowing enormous furrows in the ground. And, of course, there are no furrows. That lawn's perfectly clear, green, smooth as a putting surface, so you expect Tiger Woods to show up with his caddy and start practicing his shot. But, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff like that that shows what the government has claimed about the planes is really quite ridiculous. I mean, ridiculous. In Shanksville, it's alleged that, you know, we have footage from a couple of reporters immediately at the scene, and they're saying the strange thing about this crash is that there's no debris, there's no evidence there was a crash. And they claim, you know, there's this hole out in the ground, and Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force retired, who used to be involved in air crash investigations, told me how it looked to him as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up. And, of course, the government, the claim is this plane flew into an abandoned mine shaft, and that's why there's no remnants of the plane. Well, if that were true, then you'd expect us to bring out a whole bunch of heavy equipment and start digging it out. I mean, that's what we do when miners are trapped underground. We're working desperately round the clock. All the lights are there, you know, all the safety personnel. I mean, it's a huge enterprise on the possibility we're going to have a miracle survivor, right? At the very least, you're going to want to recover the component parts of the plane. You're going to recover the bodies. None of that was done. In fact, photographers, reporters were kept at least 1,000 feet away from the purported crash site. I mean, this is all such a monstrous hoax. It's so much in your face. I mean, there's so many lies involved here. In fact, I'll tell you, if you consider the story we've been told as a theory, like a piece of paper suspended in space, and you have these little threads coming down from the piece of paper suspended in space that are supposed to connect it to the world. So they're like the anchors that connect it to reality. We have been studying those little anchors, and none of them hold up. I mean, none of them hold up. Virtually every single thing we've been told about 9/11 by our government is false. It's quite ridiculous. In fact, even, you know, Hamilton and Keene in their book Without Precedent were admitting that they'd been lied to and bamboozled. It turns out that in a brand new book now about the commission, the author is reporting that Philip Zelikow actually had drafted an outline of the 9/11 commission report that he did not share with the staff for over a year after they began their investigation. And that Zelikow wouldn't let the staff members communicate with the commissioners themselves except through him. And of course, all this report about the witnesses and the hijackers and all that was second, third hand and all that. It was really grotesque. I mean, I'm just telling you, the way this thing was run was a complete and total sham. So when I take, you know, when I describe the book as the scamming of America, believe me, those words have only been strengthened and reinforced by subsequent developments.
Yeah. Now, one of the people that you have in your conference in August is Barbara Honegger, who's a graduate of the Naval War College and a senior author of or a journalist with the Naval War College. And she wrote a paper which is called the Pentagon Attack Paper, which is, I think, she turns up some very interesting things there. She says that, you know, and we know that the government's account is so fraught with lies that it's a gigantic smokescreen. And I think we're at the point as individuals and as researchers where we can start to really see what happened, which I think is what makes it interesting and the reason I want to rewrite my paper of 2006 to include this stuff. What she says is that between 9:30 a.m. and 9:32 a.m., many, many wall clocks in the Pentagon stopped, not only wall clocks but also wristwatches of people who were there. And that a lot of the people that weren't killed, the people who survived, say that a bomb went off, or a series of bombs, inside the Pentagon, and that this was at least 7 minutes before the official, whatever it was, hit the Pentagon. And she would say, and the official time when supposedly Flight 77 hit the Pentagon was originally, I think, 9:48 and 9:27, then it came down to 9:37. So she's saying that the MO, the modus operandi of the Pentagon, is placing of bombs inside, And then the cover story is that something's hitting it from the outside. And she makes the point that you have the same MO in the World Trade Center. You have the pre-placing of bombs inside, and then you have the cover story of planes supposedly hitting from the outside. And she would say, okay, you're using the same MO at these two places, and both take pre-placing of bombs. So this is a pretty good indication of an inside job.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's pretty rock solid, if you ask me.
Pretty good indication. Well, you know, one of the more stunning aspects of the Pentagon is that these two lime green civilian fire trucks showed up almost immediately because they were in the vicinity, and they'd actually extinguished the fires in about 15 minutes. And yet later on, when the members of Congress all pour out of the Capitol on the grounds that there's a purported threat to that structure, that it may be hit too, when they look across the Potomac, they don't see a few wisps of the lingering remnants of smoke after the fire engines have already put it out, but black billowing smoke that's actually, it turns out, coming from a series of enormous dumpsters right in front of the building. So that, you know, it's a prop, a special effect. It's absolutely stunning, and it had to be done, I think, for the obvious psychological impact it would have, that you look across the Potomac and you see, oh, yeah, man, it must be huge, because look at all that black billowing smoke. So I found a few frames that showed that it was coming from the dumpster, and then about 2 years ago, a fellow came through Duluth and showed me 44 more frames where you could actually see daylight between the building and the dumpsters. I mean, it was clear as could possibly be that these dumpsters were being used for the sake of the special effect. I mean, you know, there's signs of inside jobs all over the place.
That's not even to mention building number 7.
Oh, I know. Building 7 is, of course, so fascinating. So you have this 47-story building that would have been like the largest building in some 33 states that collapses at 5:20 in the afternoon after these, about 7 hours after the Twin Towers have been destroyed. And we learn a lot of fascinating things about that building. A friend of mine has become an expert on it and discovered that the alarm system in the building was turned on to test at 6:45 a.m., which meant that if someone sounded an alarm, then it would go to the signal fire department, but only as a test. In other words, it would be disregarded and not responded to. There were only very modest fires in that building, like at 8 on the 8th and the 9th floor and the 12th and the 13th floor. They didn't amount to anything. In fact, if the sprinkler system had been working properly, I expect it would have put them out. We do have reports from a witness or two claimed to have been inside the building and that there were a lot of explosions going on even late in the morning.
That's what I heard, too.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying I'd heard that also, but I hadn't heard a lot of information after I'd heard that person state this.
Well, we even have a couple reports of there having been a 20-second countdown that everybody knew the building was going to be brought down. And, of course, it was a complete, abrupt, total, symmetrical collapse into its own foundation. It happened in about 6.5 seconds. Peter Jennings and Dan Rather, who were on the scene, said it, you know, looked exactly like the controlled demolitions we've seen of resorts and casinos in Las Vegas so many times. And, of course, they're exactly right. I mean, that's what it was. There's just no question about it. That building was extremely robust in its construction, by the way. It was erected over two enormous generators that were providing electricity for lower Manhattan. And while even in the Twin Towers, the major support beams were hollow in the center, I mean, it was like they were like 5 inches thick, but they were hollow in the center because that provides nearly as much structural support as a solid steel beam. In this case, the Building 7 was constructed with solid steel beams just to make it that much more robust. When the Solomon brothers bought 20 or 30 floors there, they actually designed a whole new building inside the building. I mean, this is just astounding that they did this, but they completely reconfigured the building within the building, which indicates how actually sturdy this structure was. I've been inclined to believe that it may have been the most robustly constructed building the world has ever seen. So it's some kind of marvel of engineering, and yet it comes down. You know, you can see the footage on YouTube and elsewhere. There's a whole series of frames showing its demolition in the 9/11 conspiracy book to which you made reference.
And you see this little notch, you know, over from the left side about a quarter of the way in, which is something done to take out one of the main support pillars to ensure that the building will implode or fall in toward the center on itself rather than outward. It was beautifully done. I mean, there are very few companies in the world who could have executed this. And, of course, there was an expert, I think, from Sweden, but he may have been from the Netherlands, who studied this and said, you know, without knowing what building it was, that it was a very professional job, and of course it was a controlled demolition. And when he was told it was on 9/11, he expressed absolute astonishment that was the case, but of course it is.
Yeah, you know, going back to the Pentagon thing, we pretty much can prove that a 757 did not hit the Pentagon, but something hit the Pentagon. And,
right.
Left this 15-foot hole and penetrated to the inner of five rings.
Well, I think that, if I may say so, Eric, I think that very symmetrical hole in the C-ring, which is about 16 feet across, appears to have been blown out. That appears to have been done with cordite. In fact, some of the photographs actually have spray painted punch out. And I think that it was that punch out instruction was only left there by mistake. You know, somebody didn't get the word. If you have much experience with the military, you know, there's always somebody who doesn't get the word. But I mean, you know, this has got to be fraudulent. The only way you could have that perfectly symmetrical blowout is if something had hit it perfectly in the center of that area with great force. And, of course, the plane was supposed to have been coming in at an angle, and there's no reason to think that anything should have hit it straight on. So I believe that was another, you know, mode of fabricating evidence that was intended to mislead us.
Well, now, the things that I'm reading from many sources suggest it was either a missile or a smaller airplane, like an A-3 Sky Warrior.
Yeah.
Which is your preferred...
My belief is that an A-3 Sky Warrior, which was the largest plane ever designed to take off from a carrier deck, it was sometimes called the Whale, it was a fighter bomber. I believe an A-3 Sky Warrior was made up to resemble a commercial airliner, and that it fired a missile into the building before it hit the building itself. And I think there was a very specific reason for doing that, as I may or may not have explained the last time we discussed these things together. The day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld went into Congress and announced that the Pentagon had lost track of $2.3 trillion. That's quite a remarkable thing to do on a Monday, because, you know, any experienced politician will tell you release a big story like that on a Monday, it's the reporters are going to dog you all week. It's going to, as they say, grow legs, and it's not going to go away. You'd rather release it on a Friday, say, and hope that other events over the weekend will, you know, sort of cause it to disappear. It's almost as though Donald Rumsfeld knew that something was going to wipe this announcement from consciousness almost immediately, and he'd be able to waltz back into the halls of Congress and ask for hundreds of billions more in defense spending, which is exactly what he did the next day. Now, the wing of the building, the west wing that was hit, very strangely, just happened to be the only wing that had been reinforced, and they were just completing this part of it. They hadn't brought in the files and the personnel, with two exceptions. There were some members of the Office of Naval Intelligence who might well have been expected to try and figure out what's going on 9/11 if they had a whiff of this event unfolding. And also a bunch of budget analysts and accountants and financial experts who appear to have been trying to track what happened to that $2.3 trillion. So I think, you know, it's very easy to imagine the Secretary of Defense or one of his subordinates instructing the head of that unit to say, look, the Secretary had to embarrass himself by going into Congress to report we're missing that $2.3 trillion. I want you there first thing in the morning to track it all down and make sure you have all the documents and records you would need. So they get all the documents, records, and all the experts in one place, and then you fire a missile, which can be very specifically targeted, and you kill most of them. In fact, of the 125 victims from the Pentagon, between 2 and 3 dozen of them were these budget experts and accountants and so forth. So I think that actually what they did was to destroy all the documents and records to make it impossible to even conduct an investigation to figure out what happened to that $2.3 trillion. And then the plane that fired it crashed into the building, and in fact a study of the
the support columns on the ground floor that was conducted by A.K. Dewdney, a professor of computer science and an associate who's an engineer, said that the pattern was consistent with not consistent with a commercial airliner, but was consistent with a much smaller aircraft, such as an F-16 or an A-3 Sky Warrior. So I, in fact, believe that's what happened.
The main explosion, then, would have been by the missile. Is that right? And
well, several things appear to have been going on here, and this is, rather interesting. I mean, Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kawatowski writes in her chapter in the book 9/11 and American Empire, co-edited by David Ray Griffin and Imperial Scott. She was in the building, and there was this enormous explosion, but she didn't feel the impact of any plane, and she walked out there and looked around, and she didn't see any remnants of any plane. She's not the only one. April Gallup, a civilian employee who happened to have her infant with her, carried the infant out with her right through that hole and said she too couldn't see any evidence of any plane. So that's all extremely curious. I mean, putting it all together to figure out exactly how this was done is immensely challenging, and even more so, of course, in New York than it is at the Pentagon.
Well, Major Doug Rocky, who also spoke at your conference, he's done a lot of work with depleted uranium, unfortunately, and I think may have contracted Gulf War syndrome as well in Iraq. But he seems to think that depleted uranium was used in both the Pentagon and the Twin Towers attacks. Is it possible that the missile was tipped with depleted uranium, which, of course, would harden the missile and make it penetrate much
well? It could have been, Eric. Now, you know, Lauren Murray has mentioned to me that there were radiation readings, that there were Geiger counter readings that were high in the vicinity of the Pentagon, and of course that raises that possibility. I've never known quite exactly what to make of this, although obviously it's if that's sound data, then it's got to receive some sort of explanation. There's so many ways to prove there was no Boeing 757, and the one frame that the Pentagon ever did release, which is right above this gate mechanism, you can see what appears to be the outline of a plane. In particular, you see the tail and a little plume of white smoke, which pilots have assured me can't be from the engines, which emit dark smoke, but is from a missile. If you take the silhouette of a 757 and scale it to the size of the tail, the 757 is much too large. It's more than twice as large as the plane there. It would have been very conspicuous. In fact, at 155 feet, the 757 is more than twice as long as the Pentagon at 77 feet is tall. But if you impose the silhouette of an A-3 Sky Warrior, for example, you get a pretty good fit. The Sky Warrior is about half the size, is about 76 feet long. And, you know, could very well have created that image. But it's also possible it could have been an F-16. Interestingly, a fellow named John Carlson has offered several reports from workers out at a small airfield. I think it was Love Field outside of Fort Collins, Colorado, where they said that two A-3 Sky Warriors were undergoing reconstruction, that they were being equipped with missile systems and remote control guidance systems and so forth, and they thought this was very strange. It was all being done in a compartmentalized fashion so that one team working on the planes wasn't aware of another team working on the plane and so forth. But, you know, that...
Was that possibly a Raytheon plane?
Could be. I mean, I think Raytheon is implicated in an awful lot of different kinds of nefarious events.
Well, they had some passengers on supposedly on one of those planes too.
That's right. There were some major Raytheon executives who died somewhere along the way. I mean, like five or six.
Right.
The reason I find Raytheon fascinating too is because I started to mention when we first began our conversation that I also co-authored a book on the death of Senator Paul Wellstone, and that case presents a lot of anomalies that are explainable if you assume that some kind of high-tech weapon was used to hit the plane with a surge of electricity that would overwhelm the electric circuits, it would take out all the computerized components of the plane,
including the navigation system, a loudspeaker warning device, and communication devices. But it would also, more importantly, trip the solenoids, these electrical switches that control the pitch of the props. One of the great features that was a mystery in investigating that crash was that the props were on idle. So that this independent company that did the investigation here came back and reported they were on idle, which the government couldn't explain. Another peculiarity is that the fuselage, I mean the wings which carry the fuel, broke off when the plane descended through a strand of trees, and the tail broke off, but the fuselage burned with such intensity for about 7 hours that they couldn't put out the fire, and they couldn't remove the bodies. That's very strange, because it would presumably have used a lot of its fuel, though flying from St. Paul to Eveleth, Virginia Airport was only a couple hundred miles max. But one would assume that this is a kind of fire that isn't explicable on the basis of the kerosene fuel that would be, I think, those planes were using. Though, of course, I know for sure that the kerosene is used as a jet fuel, which means, of course, all these claims about how the fires melted the steel in the towers are completely ridiculous, because it's called jet fuel, and that sounds really impressive, but it's really just kerosene, the same as using a Coleman lantern or a Coleman stove. When I was a kid, we used to go camping, and I noticed that the Coleman lantern and the stove didn't melt. Even though we might be burning this fuel, you know, extensively for hours. In fact, you'd expect the engines would be falling off of aircraft, because those engines that are burning the jet fuel are principally made out of steel with some titanium components. But, I mean, the whole idea is completely ridiculous. In fact, it turns out the melting point of steel is 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, and the highest temperature you can attain with a jet fuel-based fire is only 1,800 degrees. That's 1,000 degrees difference.
Are you familiar with any of the work of Alex Constantine? The journalist?
That I know that. Mel, tell me more about.
Well, he's if you type him on the net, he has some incredible journalistic research into following up some of these corporate anomalies that took place with 9/11. Some of them being the SEC looking into, what was it, WorldCom and Enron, the paperwork and that sort of, the files would have been in the building number 7.
What's his name again? I'll put it in.
Alex Constantine. You can spend hours on his site. He is just phenomenal.
Okay.
And, but he
on the insider trading.
Right. Right.
For example, yeah, that's all very serious. In fact, I just had Phil Berg, who's a former deputy attorney general for the state of Pennsylvania and a founding member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. He and I gave a press conference together along with George Nelson in front of the federal courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, when Zacharias Moussaoui was undergoing this trial to determine whether his punishment should be life imprisonment or death in April of 2006. Where we were explaining that this whole thing was quite ridiculous, that the government was playing a shell game, because the crime for which he was convicted a year earlier in April of 2005 was of a plot to attack the White House to free the blind sheik involved in the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, how he denied he had anything to do with 9/11, and yet here a year later they were trying him for, you know, life or imprisonment or even death for not coming forward and explaining he was involved in this plot, because if the FBI knew, they might have been able to save some lives. This is extraordinary and ridiculous on many counts. As Webster Tarpley pointed out to me a long time ago, I mean, he had a Fifth Amendment right. Nobody has the obligation to come forward and incriminate themselves. This, and as I've already pointed out, this was not the crime for which he was convicted, so there's been a complete switch taking place here. And in addition, they had an FBI agent who had to be profoundly embarrassing to the prosecutors, who said how he'd been tracking Moussaoui, and how he thought he might be involved in using planes as weapons, you know, and he even mentioned the World Trade Center as a target, but later he said that was just a lucky guess, who testified that he had reported his suspicions to his superiors, not once or twice, but 70 times. And I say, hey, five or six, you know, ignoring it could be simple incompetence. two dozen, 24, 25, that's got to be criminal neglect. When you get up to 70 times, this has to be a matter of deliberate policy where they knew about these guys, and they wanted to keep them under wraps in order to roll them out as the patsies when whatever they were planning finally came down. But the idea that Misawi might have to receive the death penalty because he didn't come forward, when if he had come forward, they might have done something to save lives, is so dramatically contradicted by one of their own FBI agents who 70 times came forward and absolutely nothing was done to save any lives. Just shows what a travesty. This was a show trial. This was something that was suitable for the Soviet Union. But of course, you know, we're discovering so many aspects of our political lives these days have parallels either in Nazi Germany or in Stalinist Russia.
I need to give a station ID here.
Sure.
And this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, Truth Quest with Melody and Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And our guest this evening is Jim Fetzer, who has done a lot of research and written on 9/11 truth and also on JFK assassination. Go ahead.
Eric, where would you like to go at this point?
Well, you know, there's so many ways to go here. I would just going back to the Pentagon, I just have to give my impressions that,
sure,
you know, having looked at the pictures, I don't see a lot of evidence for an A3 Sky Warrior. It seems to me a missile is all that hit that building.
Well, you do have the tail. You do have the tail.
Remember, there were some individuals who had suits and ties, or at least white shirts and ties, who were seen sprinkling debris on the clean Pentagon lawn,
right?
Just after, and it seems to me that, and there was even a big box covered in a blue tarp, and it seems, and
right,
the Pentagon people could have been sprinkling pieces of, and you yourself said that Karen Kotowski or whatever her name is,
Kotowski,
and this gal April saw no debris of a plane.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, that clear smoking and the clear green lawn, which is absolutely uncluttered with any debris whatsoever after the crash has all taken place, or whatever's taken place has taken place, is the smoking gun there in so many different ways. And it's clear that this debris was planted. In fact, there's this one piece from an airline crash that was actually moved around and photographed in different locations. Is Jack White, who is a expert on the photos and films of the JFK assassination and who became interested in 9/11, discovered. But there's a fellow in Columbus, an attorney, who spent a lot of time doing research on that, and it turns out it's a piece of debris that came from a plane crash in Calais, Colombia in 1998 that apparently was brought up for the purpose of serving as a prop. I mean, all this is so this all so completely ridiculous, you know.
But
when I talk about the tail of the plane, I mean in the frame of the original five frames that the Pentagon released. The very first one, you know, look in the lower right-hand corner, is conveniently labeled plane, and all the others are labeled impact, and you see this huge fireball. And in that frame labeled plane, and in the three videos that they have released subsequently under duress, which are only three of what we take to be 84 videos that should show what actually happened, which just tells you how much they have to conceal, you can see this one same frame where you actually see the tail of a plane. I mean, I'm saying, you know, there is an indication that a plane was present, and you have the silhouette of what appears to be a much smaller aircraft. Now, in addition to that, of course, you have the aide in the underground bunker where Norman Mineta observes him coming up to Vice President Cheney and saying, sir, it's 50 miles out, sir, it's 30 miles out, sir, it's 10 miles out, did the order still stand? And Cheney gets really angry with him and whips his head around and says, of course the order still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? Where the order had to be to not shoot the plane down. I mean, when you know planes are being used as weapons, the obvious thing to do is to shoot it down. Then you lose the passengers and the aircraft, but you don't also lose the personnel and the property at the target. And I think the aide would not have had anxiety if the order had been to shoot it down. Not only that, but since the Pentagon has to be perhaps the most heavily defended building in the world, if the order had been to shoot it down, it would have been shot down. Instead of...
You go ahead.
Yeah. And then, of course, we also have this photograph the BBC ran that appears to have been taken with a cell phone camera by somebody who was working at Arlington Cemetery. And as you may recall from my presentation with which the... the Science and Politics DVD begins, because I wanted to give a broad overview before we went into depth and different aspects of these issues. It shows a very a plane with a very swept back wings, which is quite unlike the 757, whose wings extend more or less, more nearly straight outward. They're slightly swept back, but on a 750, on a A3 Sky Warrior, they're very much swept back. So for reasons like these, I'm inclined to think that it may have been an A3 Sky Warrior. I spell that all out in my chapter entitled Thinking About Conspiracy Theories on 9/11 and JFK, which you can actually find online if you just put that title in. There's a copy of it on 9/11 Scholar's website, so you can, you not only you get an analysis using the principles of scientific reasoning about 9/11, but also I begin with a summary overview about JFK and show how the same principles lead to the conclusion that he was taken out as the result of a conspiracy that was concealed by a very elaborate cover-up.
Jim, what I'd like to kind of...
It's on the planes here before we leave this.
Okay.
Sure.
I think the white jet the plane that Cheney supposedly kept from being fired upon, I think this might have been the white jet that was seen at all three sites by witnesses, and that this was the kind of the mobile Pentagon in the sense that it was a surveillance plane that Cheney was in contact with. And I've read this. This is not just my scenario. And the actual plane that might have done a 270 degree turn, as seen by FAA controllers on the radar, would have been a military plane that was a surveillance plane to see if there was any plane wreckage, and that plane reported that they didn't see any plane wreckage in front of the Pentagon. But the reason that the disparity of time between 9:30 and 9:32, which is where the clock stopped, and 9:37 or so, when the official version says that the Pentagon was hit, the reason that the Pentagon has kept that later time is because this is when the FAA air controllers saw this military jet do this 270-degree turn. Thereby, that would be they would say that was Flight 77. So I think there were a number of planes in the sky, but I don't think a plane hit the Pentagon. I think a missile hit the Pentagon.
Well, all I can say is, that the study of the damage to the support columns provided by A.K. Dewdney and his engineer associate supported that it couldn't have been a large plane, but it could have been, was consistent with a smaller aircraft, and that combined with the other elements I've described has brought me the point of belief that, in fact, a small plane did hit the building. But I'm not denying the possibility that some other scenario might be correct. You happen to recall your source on that? I'm rather fascinated by what you've been saying.
Well, yeah, a lot of that's coming out of Barbara Honegger's paper, which is the Pentagon attack.
Yeah, which is an papers. Appendix in Jim Marr's book, The Terror Conspiracy.
Yeah.
Let me just say, by the way, I mentioned the Pilots for 9/11 Truth, and they've done some very good stuff. They have a study called Pandora's Black Box that is based on an analysis of black box data that they were provided under a Freedom of Information request by the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, that was, according to the government, is supposed to be the data for Flight 77. So they subjected it to an analysis, and they discovered that the approach and the altitude and so forth, the direction, are all completely different than the government claims, and that the government, of course, has a very tight angle between the plane and the building, so it actually it's hitting there at an angle so steep that the right wing would have hit the building first and probably cause a rotation, in a clockwise direction that should have snapped the tail off. Morgan Reynolds has discovered footage of planes landing, and they just land a little harder than they should, and the tail snaps off. So it's perfectly reasonable to suppose that if the government's account were true, that the tail ought to have snapped off. But that, it's coming in more or less in a northeastern lead direction, whereas based upon their research, the plane was actually coming in an almost easterly direction, almost perpendicular to the building, that at the point where it's supposed to be low enough to be knocking down lampposts. It's actually 300 feet in the air, and which is when it's only 1 second away from impact with the building, at which point the data breaks off, it's still 100 feet too high to have hit the building, which is consistent with a report of a friend of from the buddy of a friend of mine I know from JFK research, who's a trucker, who wrote to my, you know, told my friend that he had seen a large commercial plane fly toward the building but then swoop over it, you know, didn't actually hit it. And my friend was writing me to ask me, he said, you know, what's strange here is he insisted a plane did hit the building even though he didn't see a plane hit the building. So that, you know, I've been disposed to believe that there may have been a large commercial carrier there, that it, if that flight data was from that plane, then that it did swoop over the building. In fact, these pilots are doing a really good job. I'm very impressed with some of these more specialized groups, and one of the reasons why I have, a lot of belief that we're actually sorting these things out pretty well.
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, if we could, you asked me what I wanted to ask about. Going back to the World Trade Center 1 and 2, Judy Wood, this very creative scientist, has come up with a paradigm which is quite different from the others. Until she came along, the two main theories as to how the World Trade Center 1 and 2 came down was cutter charges such as thermite or thermite, military-grade explosives, which would have been pre-placed. And the other one was mini nukes. And then she comes along and she sees evidence for directed energy weapons, she thinks. But, of course, this is stuff that has not been used on such a grand scale anywhere in the world. So this is a fairly controversial position.
Yeah.
Could you explain how, as best you can, what her position is and whether you support it?
Well, the stages of scientific inquiry are four. One is puzzlement. You got some phenomenon you can't explain. It doesn't fit into your background knowledge, and therefore you want to sort it out. Now, in this case, we have the what's puzzling is a whole variety of things. That these buildings were destroyed in approximately 10 seconds. That's preposterous. I mean, below the 80th floor on the South Tower and the 96th on the North, this was basically stone-cold steel. 47 support columns, 240 external columns. I mean, you had 287 columns on every single floor that would have to be simultaneously broken in order for the building to collapse in 10 seconds. I mean, it's preposterous to think it could have happened that way. The idea of thermite is really, in my opinion, a stretch. And, of course, I invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair when I created Scholars, and we had a very amiable relationship right up until the point when I became exposed to the huge range of phenomena that require explanation, you know, including the toasted cars, including the dustification, the fact that the concrete and the steel and the office furniture, the computers, the desks, the chairs, the human beings and other living things were all turned into this very fine dust. And it was obvious to me that no cutter charges or conventional explosives were going to be able to account for this, much less the 1,400 toasted cars, not to mention, you know, a whole bunch of other aspects of all this. I mean, the foundation, you know, the so-called bathtub, which created a dike that kept the Hudson River water from flooding beneath lower Manhattan, which were it to have occurred, would have been catastrophic because it would not only undermine the foundations of other massive buildings, but it would have flooded the subways and path train tunnels and created a chaotic situation, basically freezing lower Manhattan. And, of course, business would have ground largely to a halt, and you would have had, you know, billions of dollars and months of cleanup. It would have been a horrendous mess. That didn't happen. Well, these buildings weighed 500,000 tons. If those 500,000-ton buildings had come down, even if it was in parts, it would have shattered the bathtub, and you would have had that flooding. Well, it didn't happen because the buildings were being dustified, turned into very fine dust. You know, Judy used this memorable metaphor as though you had two gigantic trees that were turning to sawdust from the top down. So something's going on here that, in my judgment, can't be explained by conventional explosives plus thermite, that's just a fantasy. And it was at that point that Steve and I began to have a divergence, because I thought it was indispensable
to consider unconventional explanations, whether it was nukes, mini nukes, atomic, hydrogen, fourth generation, whatever, or lasers, masers, plasmoids, some kind of directed energy weapon, that was indispensable to look at unconventional sources. And this, of course, was quickly seized upon by those who wanted to, I think, throw a monkey wrench into new research on this subject by broadening the range of alternative hypotheses, who started immediately talking about, you know, death rays from space and all this kind of stuff, in part, perhaps unfortunately, because the first interview I had with Judy about this after I became exposed to her website on the 11th of November 2006, when I was out at Tucson, she had said to me, you know, we were talking about this, and I was so excited about this huge range of new data that required explanation. And I was asking, you know, what kind of weapon could have been involved here? And she was suggesting it could have been one of these high-tech weapons, possibly a laser. And I said, well, where did you think it could have been located? You know, and I think I may have even suggested at that point Building 7. And she offered the possibility, no, no. And I said, well, what's your best guess? And she said, space. Now, that sounds, you know, really far out. And I think that one word on that one occasion led to all this mass of ridicule that is completely undeserved, because these high-tech weapons can be based on ground. They can be based in aircraft. You can there's reports of a 747 that's been equipped with a huge, gigantic laser. It could be in a dirigible or a blimp. It could be satellite-based. I mean, people who ridicule that idea are simply either professing their ignorance or feigning a lack of knowledge, because we have a whole history of the development of all these exotic weapons as a part of the Star Wars research program, which Bob Bowman himself used to direct, where Bowman has a PhD in nuclear engineering from Caltech.
What's his feeling on that?
Well, specifically, the most interesting observation he's made of late, and that's a great question, Mel. Actually, I should get Bob on and grill him about this, because for God's sake, this is his area of expertise. I've never done that. I should do that. Is that he acknowledged that the Star Wars program was always offensive. It was never defensive. Well, whether it's offensive or defensive, it's got to employ weapons. And if they're going to be in space, then you're going to have space-based weapons. So this is no reach at all. In fact, Bob Petraeus has published a book about these kinds of weapons. I may even have it at hand.
I've got it here, Jim.
Yeah.
Petraeus Files, Star Wars, Weather Mods, and Full Spectrum Dominance.
You're right. I just found it myself. Where Bob's okay. Talking about, you know, these developments, and I've gone back myself and found, you know, in 66, 76, 86, or, you know, around these periods of time, you're having all these major developments going on, and the HARP system is really quite elaborate. And there are major developments, and early, I don't know, it was 79, they had a low-intensity laser deflected off of a mirror on a space-based satellite, and it came back and down on exactly the location specified for the target. And after that, they made the program highly classified. Well, that's the way the military operates. But for somebody to ridicule it because, you know, it's impossible or these weapons don't exist is just making pretensions. How could they possibly know they don't exist?
Well, because for one reason, there's the company is based in Albuquerque, and it's a rather large company. I can't think of the name of it at the moment, but Applied Research or something of that sort. I can't think of it at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, outside Tucson, there's a huge Raytheon facility, for example. I started to mention the Raytheon thing in relation to Wellstone. The fact is that the plane that Wellstone was on, Air King 100, is owned by Beechcraft, and Beechcraft is owned by Raytheon. And Raytheon also has the patents on several, you know, probably quite a few at this point, of these directed energy weapons. So I think that a simple phone call, for example, from the Secretary of Defense to Raytheon could elicit information on exactly what was needed to take down the plane that the senator was going to be flying in. And that it was my opinion is this was a relatively small-scale conspiracy, probably involving no more than 10 or 12 people, where I believe the decision-makers were Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Rove,
and that they used Raytheon to find out exactly what was necessary, and then they had just a small unit in a van of just a couple people, and the key was getting the plane into the kill zone so they could zap it and turn the props on idle, which means you have no forward thrust and you're destined to crash. But that doesn't explain the bizarre burning of the fuselage, which actually reduced the whole contents to charcoal. If somebody wants to see what I'm talking about, I after publishing the book with a Native American scholar from Northern Arizona University, a fellow by the name of Don Jacobs, but his Indian name is Four Arrows, or translates as Four Arrows, I continued to do research on the Wellstone case with a fellow with a PhD in electromagnetism, because, you know, I mean, this is a special area of knowledge. So I flew him up from Australia. Now, this is a guy I'd done research with on JFK, so, you know, I'd actually flown him up from Australia before for a conference on the Zapruder film, and he provided the most brilliant scientific proof of the alteration of the film in the history of the study of the death of JFK. But anyhow, in the, you know, middle of winter and 35 below zero weather, we were tramping around at the crash scene and picking up little parts of the remnants of the fuselage. And he and I did a study, it was principally his effort, going through the some 2,500 pages of documents and reports that, on which the NTSB's own study, which was only about 75 or 80 pages long, was based. According to the NTSB, the plane crashed because the pilots lost track of their airspeed and altitude, which is so completely ridiculous I can't begin to tell you. I mean, the principal pilot, a guy named Richard Connery, was highly qualified. He had 5,200 hours of experience. He had an air transport pilot certification, which is the highest civilian short of an astronaut. And he had just passed his FAA flight check within 2 days of the fatal flight. And then he was accompanied by Michael Glass, who was his co-pilot, who wasn't, you know, as qualified, but was qualified to fly the plane. I mean, you know, losing track of airspeed and altitude, those are the two most important things you must keep track of. And, you know, not only that, but it not only is it incredibly improbable that one pilot would lose track of his airspeed or altitude, that two would do it, you know, you got to multiply the probabilities. And then this plane was equipped with this loud stall warning alarm. I mean, this is a very sophisticated aircraft. It's something like the Rolls-Royce of small planes. And the whole government account had just a negligible probability. But we discovered, you know, various indications about the use of a high-tech weapon, such as that it would explain why there was no warning, you know, no call of distress, why they might have not ever heard any warning alarm because it was zapped and, you know, the pilot's navigation aids and communication was cut off and the planes were flipped onto solenoid. There was an old cell phone anomaly of a guy who was a lobbyist for the city of Duluth with the Minnesota legislature, was in the immediate vicinity and said he got a cell phone call in on his phone right about 10:20 in the morning, which is about the time this plane is going down, and it was a lot of loud wailing and warbling sound like he never heard before. Well, John P. Costello, who's the PhD in electromagnetism, told me the wailing warbling indicated that it was man-made, that this wouldn't be a natural phenomenon, but that the periodicity would indicate it had a human source. And what happens if you got this electromagnetic field in the air, see that the cell phone functions as a receiver, and just because it had got this incoming call, it had picked up this electromagnetic phenomenon in the area, that unless it was some natural source of a high level of electromagnetism, it would have to be an artificial source of electromagnetism. We also had reports from a physician in Duluth, and I actually spoke with a physician who had patients who reported that day their garage doors were open, even though they themselves had not opened them.
That happens quite a bit in Colorado Springs. I have a friend that lives by the Broadmoor that has that happen quite a bit, which is near NORAD.
Okay. So something's going on there that's triggered it off there, right? But up in Eveleth, Virginia, I can assure you this is very rare. I mean, this is a very remote area. There's not a whole lot going on up there. But get this. So we had a far more probable explanation of what occurred, but when we were pouring through all these 2,500 pages of reports, John discovered a meteorological phenomenon that the meteorologist couldn't explain, which was that there was a circular patch at the ice level in the atmosphere right above the crash scene that was all melted. Well, that's very curious. I mean, this fire, the intensity of a fire falls off very, very fast. I mean, just consider when you have a fireplace fire, and when you're real close it seems hot, but you step back just a few feet, right? So I expect there's an inverse square law for the you know, the radiation from the fire, the heat from the fire. But it's not sufficient to cause any melting at the ice level. On the other hand, the use of one of these high-tech weapons would do that as a residual effect. So I think there we found, you know, a really conclusive confirmation of what was already an extremely powerful case. So you got this puzzling phenomenon, then you have to look at the full range of alternative hypotheses. Now get this, in relation to Wellstone, this is absolutely stunning. The NTSB, as a matter of policy, will not consider any non-accident hypotheses to explain a crash unless the Attorney General declares that this is a crime scene. So if you have a complicit or compliant attorney general, all he has to do is to decline to declare it a crime scene, and the NTSB is restricted to considering only accident-compatible hypotheses, in this case, the plane, the weather, or the pilots. Now, I've actually already explained the pilots were highly qualified. The weather was really quite mild for that time. We had a pilot who was outside, who was in real estate, sent me a couple of pictures across water he had taken, in about 20 or 30 minutes, and only a couple miles away from the crash site. And not only was there no freezing rain or snow or bad weather, there wasn't even any rain. There wasn't even a ripple on the water. So, I mean, this was just ridiculous, even though Wolf Blitzer was reporting on national television how terrible the weather was. And we had a local weatherman, an anchor in Duluth by the name of Danny Anderson, who's himself also a pilot, kept repeatedly correcting them about the weather. But it was being used, see, to try to create the impression that there was a natural explanation for this accident. I mean, another aspect of that was that that Blitzer was saying, well, they've closed the airport, and, you know, that really tells it all. But anytime you have a plane crash in relation to an airport, you close the airport because you don't know if there's something about the airport that may have caused the plane to crash. So that's simply standard operating procedure. So they were turning something that would happen in any case into as though it were a telling sign that the plane had been brought down by this freezing rain and this bad weather, which wasn't the case.
Do you see a relation between the Wellstone and the 9/11 then?
Well, Wellstone died in 2002 on October 25th, so it was after 9/11, which of course was 9/11-2001. But Wellstone was an outspoken critic of the administration. He had given a speech condemning them, and before the speech he'd been warned by Dick Cheney, who told him, and Wellstone shared this with veterans in Wilmer, Minnesota, not long thereafter, that if he posed them on Iraq, that there would be severe ramifications for him personally and for the state of Minnesota. I can't imagine more severe ramifications than actually taking him out. And that's the way these people play ball. I mean, these are rotten bastards. These are killers. These are thieves. These are murderers. There's no question about it in my mind.
Okay, then you're saying that if it's an inside job, and you're talking about there has to be a modus operandi is why you even would even consider the Star Wars, and so what is your motive that you would think that they, we would have an inside job there? With 9/11.
Well, you're talking about 9/11, or
right, 9/11.
See, with Wellstone, he was also the key to regaining Republican control of the Congress, of the Senate. See?
Right, right.
And in fact, after Wellstone's death, that combined with the loss by Max Cleland in Georgia, which was very peculiar. He was a war hero, you know, a paraplegic, widely admired on all sides, and yet these voting machines were all turning out the same number. It was very bizarre. Anyone remotely familiar with computer science would know these machines were all rigged. They stole the election. I mean, Georgia had a tradition of electing senators and governors and keeping them in office indefinitely. But in this case, the governor and the senator were turned out in a single after a single term. The whole thing was ridiculous, but it was to guarantee. I mean, this is Karl Rove's modus operandi, to guarantee that that the Senate would go Republican. And, you know, that then became the great facilitator. That Senate never put up a whimper of opposition to any of the absurdities like the Patriot Act or the Military Commissions Act or all this other nonsense, and of course, you know, supported this authorization that Bush has used to justify going to war. That was an abdication responsibility by the Congress, because it should have insisted that there would have, before you could go to war, there'd have to be a declaration by Congress, and preceded, of course, by a suitable debate. Now, if you want to know what was going on, why 9/11? Well, $2.3 trillion is a non-trivial motive, right? Here you get rid of all the evidence and you're able to get away with $2.3 trillion. The controller of the Pentagon at the time was a fellow named Dov Zakheim, who has joint U.S.-Israeli citizenship. So I think that you know, why somebody with a joint citizenship should be in a position like that is utterly irresponsible, because for all you know, their allegiance to the other nation may be greater than their allegiance to the United States. It's not the only case like that. There were these five so-called dancing Israelis on a rooftop across the Hudson who were taking films of the destruction of the World Trade Center and celebrating and drinking, who were later apprehended, and they were incarcerated for about 5 months, and then they were released and allowed to return to Israel, where three of them went on television and gave interviews that you can find on the Internet, where they said that they were there to record the destruction of the World Trade Center. Well, it's no great leap of logic to understand they couldn't have been there to film the record the destruction of the World Trade Center if they didn't know the World Trade Center was going to be destroyed. So the person who directed their release, by the way, was the then assistant to Attorney General John Ashcroft, a fellow by the name of Michael Chertoff, who also has joint U.S.-Israeli citizenship, and, of course, who is today the Secretary of Homeland Security. So once again, I raise the same question. How are you going to put somebody who's got a dual loyalty in a position like that when their loyalty to the other nation may be greater than their loyalty to the United States? Larry Silverstein, who bought took the control of the World Trade Center for the first time into private hands 6 months before, had to know, because it was a matter of record, that the buildings were laden with asbestos, that the Port Authority had been, concerned and putting pressure to have that asbestos removed, that if you put scaffolding around the buildings to remove it would run around $1 billion. 6 weeks before the 9/11, he insured the buildings for $3.5 billion against terrorist attack, and then because there were two planes, he claimed it was a double indemnity and he should get $7 billion. He actually got something like $4.4 billion. Not a bad return on an investment of his own part of less than $125 million. The guy's called Lucky Larry. Of course, it was he who explained during a PBS interview that what happened with Building 7 was he had a conversation with the and there's this verbal pause, fire commander, and I think that verbal pause indicates he also knew this guy under a different designation. He told him that there had been so much loss of life that perhaps the best thing to do was to pull it. He said they made the decision to pull, and we watched the building come down. Well, that's quite fascinating. I mean, pull means bring down by a controlled demolition, but you couldn't do that unless it was already prepared. So that building had to be already prepared for a controlled demolition, which then took place after Larry Silverstein had this phone conversation. And of course, if Building 7 was prepped for a controlled demolition, then why not Buildings 1 and 2? Now, one of the fascinating aspects of Steve Jones' hypothesis about thermite is his speculation about how much would have been required. In the paper of his that I discuss on 9/11 scholars, if you scroll down the home page to a section entitled The Science of 9/11, you'll see quite a bit of exchange between me and Steve, including some that was actually filmed out in Chandler, Arizona, during a later meeting when we were talking about our differences here. And Steve said in this, so it could have been 10 tons of this stuff would have been required. Well, 10 tons? Give me a break. I mean, we're talking about this remarkable design of this tube within a tube construction. It was quite brilliant. These buildings were designed to withstand the impact of the then largest commercial airliners, which were Boeing 707s. In fact, Frank DeMartini, who was the project manager for the World Trade Center, said he thought they could withstand multiple impacts at the intricate lattice structure and the redundant, sophisticated load redistribution capabilities that came with it. Meant that you could have multiple impacts without damaging the structural integrity of the buildings. He likened it to sticking pencils through mosquito netting. So, practically everything the public's been told about 9/11 just ain't so. And, of course, I started to talk about the temperature, which I probably discussed in spades before, but even the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, studied 236 samples of steel that they selected. And they discovered that 235 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees, and the other three not above 1,200 degrees. Well, Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel used in the building for 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours without warping or bending or weakening, a certification that was vindicated in 1975 when there was a fire in the North Tower on the 11th floor that consumed some 80% of the floor, enveloped the core columns, burned around 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours, and yet none of the steel had to be replaced. In fact, it's fascinating to observe that the amount of time involved for those fires, which were of so low temperature, was only an hour in the South Tower, an hour and a half in the North Tower. So the fires burned neither hot enough nor long enough to cause any of the steel to weaken, much less melt. Plus, if you had had a weakening or melting, you would have had the, when the fire was distributed asymmetrically, you would have had a little sagging here, you know, a little collapse there, but it would have been gradual, taken forever, wouldn't have gone anywhere.
What about William Rodriguez? Have you ever interviewed him for
sure.
your
Yeah, mm-hmm. Willie was right here in Madison, and we went to his talk, and we went out to dinner, and we had extensive conversations. Now, he was in the North Tower, where he was a senior custodian, and he reported a massive explosion in the sub-basement prior to any vibrations from something hitting the building. Now, this is such a fascinating evidence of an inside job that two members of scholars, Craig Furlong and Gordon Ross, decided to check this out, and they got very exact data about the reverberations from the explosion in the sub-basement from seismic data maintained by an observatory run by Columbia University, and they compared that with very precise information from FAA and radar data about when the planes allegedly hit the building, and they discovered that the explosion of the sub-basements were occurring as much as 14 to 17 seconds before the planes allegedly hit the buildings. So, Willie was talking about how the basement's filled up with water. I am disposed to believe that a principal reason for those explosions was to take the water out of the sprinkler systems because the fires were so modest that if the sprinkler systems had been operating, they would have extinguished them, just as in the case of Building 7. The fire extinguishers ought to have extinguished the fires, and I don't know why they would have been shut off, but I presume they actually were in Building 7, too.
And the pools of molten metal and the missing gold?
No, I think that molten metal business is extremely dubious, and let me give you several reasons to think so. If there had been these massive pools of molten metal, and this is something that Stephen Jones talks about all the time, and one of the differences we have is that some of the photographic evidence he uses is purporting to show this evidence of the molten metal is fabricated or faked. For just the most striking example is there's a group of these workers peering into a cavern, and the cavern is all aglow. Some of them, have their sleeves rolled up, they're peering down, no special protection. Well, this is absurd. If you just had a tea kettle that is starting to whistle, you wouldn't open the spout and put your face over the spout, and that's only a little over 212 degrees. This molten metal would be around 3,000 degrees. If that actually were, channeling heat from the molten metal, the flesh would be melting off of their bodies. This is such an obviously fake photograph that after I pointed it out in Chandler, Steve went back and took the photograph off of the paper he had on his website. So, this is just one indication. But here, let me say more. If there were those massive pools of molten metal, and if the Hudson River, if the bathtub had broken and the Hudson River water had come in, then there would have been these massive steam explosions. You may recall in New York where a steam pipe broke and this poor man in a pickup truck fell into it, and he had these steam burns around 80% of his body, third-degree burns. I don't think he survived. But the point is, steam is an extremely painful way to die. It's radical expansion of your cells. It's really awful. So the idea that you would have had the combination of that Hudson River water with the massive molten metal is impossible unless you had steam explosion. So either you didn't have the water or you didn't have the molten metal. Well, you didn't have the Hudson River water. But get this, 11 million gallons of water were poured on the North Tower and the South Tower of that World Trade Center site. Now, that wasn't Hudson River water, but it was water. And if there had been molten metal, then there would have been massive steam explosions. You got 11 million gallons of water. Now, you got something that looks kind of like mist or something coming off, and Judy has been particularly brilliant about, performing premature closure by subsuming things that look like things you're familiar with by means of the more familiar concepts, such as that's actually smoke or steam, because it actually appears to be some kind of a fuming from a process of molecular dissociation. In other words, whatever was used to bring those buildings apart caused the molecules to actually break apart. Would you know there were 1,100 bodies that were never recovered? I mean, not just not an arm, not just not a leg. not even a fingernail. I mean, there was nothing. They were turned completely into very fine dust, just as the steel and the concrete. A process of molecular dissociation that breaks the molecular bonds would do this, and it would have residual effects. So I think this is maybe Judy's most brilliant observation. You've got these workers out there, and they're working in this fuming area, but they don't appear to be suffering any ill effects. Well, if that were steam, they'd be suffering no effects because they'd basically be being steamed like they were oysters.
Well, that one might also have something to do with some of them having all those lung problems, not just being the asbestos, but maybe those fumes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You mean the damage to the workers and the first responders?
Right, right.
Absolutely. Oh, this was a terrible toxic mixture, and that Christy Whitman, you know, should have assured people that the EPA said this was all safe to breathe is completely outrageous. I mean, it not only included, you know, the very fine powder from the demolecularization of the steel and the concrete, but also the heavy metals that were in the computers, you know, arsenic, mercury, all this kind of stuff. Whatever was actually used to blow it up. I mean, you know, whatever it was, this was terrible, terrible stuff to breathe. We're going to have more deaths from first responders from breathing this stuff by probably an order of five. If you had about 3,000 people dead, we're going to have about 15,000 that are going to die from breathing this stuff. It's terrible.
Eric, are you...
back to what you said about the fabricated photos that Dr. Stephen Jones used of molten metal.
Yeah.
Now, one of the comments that Barbara Honegger made on your video or at that talk was the third imperative of the perpetrators is to control the opposition. In other words, you have to pull off the operation, you have to cover up the operation, and somehow you have to try to control the opposition.
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me that if you are using faked photographs,
yeah,
there is no kind of genuine positive reason for doing that. No one would use faked photographs whose intentions were purely scientific.
Of course. Well, I mean, the problem is, was Steve taken in, or was Steve knowing? I mean, you know, once I had talked about this, and I talked about a couple others, and why I was very skeptical about, you know, his whole approach, which is based, by the way, on the analysis of a sample of dust that came from a specific apartment. And he has had the I don't know quite how to describe it, gumption to even provide a diagram of where the sample of dust is supposed to have come down from the 80th floor of one of the towers and into this woman's apartment. Well, you got dust there. It's got a nonspecific origin. Who knows where the hell that dust came? Not only that, but the National Geological Survey studied hundreds of samples of dust. Steve Jones has one sample of dust. You need dust from different altitudes, you know, found at all different places, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's ridiculous to think you could have one little sample of dust and that's all you need. And yet he repeatedly says he's got his little sample of dust and that's all he needs. Well, that's completely ridiculous. There are four stages of the scientific inquiry. They are puzzlement, speculation, where you got to consider the full range of alternative hypotheses. Notice how that was not done by the NTSB in studying Wellstone, because they excluded non-accident compatible alternatives such as a small bomb or a gas canister or a high-tech weapon. They never considered any of those. Well, then in the third place, you got to adapt the evidence to the hypotheses. You got to figure out which hypothesis, if true, would confer the highest probability on the evidence. And I say, well, obviously the planes hitting the building, you know, confers zero probability on the evidence. In fact, it's not even possible, so I call that even lower than zero, null, because these effects couldn't possibly have been brought about by the government's official explanation. Also, if you look at natural explanation like a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake, of course, these are all very concentrated on the World Trade Center. It's as though the terrorists want to destroy all and only buildings with a WTC designation. This is obviously not a naturally occurring phenomenon. Then you start looking at the conventional explosive, thermite, and I say, well, most of those buildings would have come down. They would have cracked the concrete if, you know, that constituted the bathtub. If one of these conventional explosive explanations were true, plus it would require this staggering amount of thermite, 10 tons by Steve's calculation. I just don't see any way it can account for the range and variety. I mean, we got problems with building 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, the 1,400 toasted cars and all that. I don't see any way such an explanation can begin to cut it. So, I mean, I think that the probability of all these effects, given any of these conventional explanations, is approximately zero. Then we have to start looking at the alternatives.
the nuke, the mini nuke, the hydrogen atomic, fourth generation, laser, maser, plasmoid. At the, I don't know, Eric, if you remember at the very end, I invited, you know, members who had, persons who had come to the conference to come up and, you know, offer comments in response to what they'd learned. And this older woman, oh, I would guess she might be around 70 years old, came up and explained she had a PhD in physics. And that she was, after watching Judy's work, she couldn't believe how much she had missed with her own eyes, but she was now convinced that masers had been involved, and she started to explain why she thought masers were involved. Well now, see, this is what we need, people with this highly, sophisticated understanding of some of these mechanisms, which I freely admit goes beyond my capacity to explain, but where I recognize there's no way that conventional mechanisms can account for the data. So you got, you know, it's like the probability that the two pilots both neglected their airspeed and altitude and allow stall warning device. I mean, that's got a zero probability. The conventional explanation in the case of the towers got a zero probability. Now, you can buy that if you want, as I used to say, that the government's explanation, the official account, is just fine if you're willing to believe impossible things. And I say, you know, it's virtually the same with the Wellstone crash. This is ridiculous. People who have read my book, you know, this co-authored book with Four Arrows, are just stunned because, you know, I'm so patient in going through how you apply these stages of puzzlement, speculation, adaptation, and then when you have enough evidence, when all the evidence tends to settle down, then the hypothesis that if true would confer the highest probability on the evidence, which is the preferable hypothesis, is acceptable when the evidence settles down and all points in the same direction. Now, Steve has a different conception of scientific method. He says it's a matter of forming an hypothesis, testing the hypothesis, writing up your results and publishing it, you know, having it peer-reviewed and then publishing it. Well, this is wrong. This isn't even about the logic of scientific reasoning. This is a process scientists may go through, but it's not, doesn't explain the logic of scientific reasoning. Number one, you can't just look at one hypothesis apart from other alternatives. You've got to be comparing them. It's the comparison of the likelihoods, technically, is the name given to the, if the hypothesis were true, what's the probability of the evidence? That's known as the likelihood, which is a measure of the evidential support that the evidence, if true, would confer upon the hypothesis. You've got to compare them. It's only by comparing the hypotheses, you know, which is the preferable hypothesis. So he's got it all wrong from scratch. Plus, peer reviews can be rigged. When Steve first founded the journal, I told him, look, Steve, because I had founded a journal myself called Minds and Machines. It turned out to be a huge success, an international journal devoted to artificial intelligence, philosophy, and cognitive science. And the what I spent most time on was planning how to put together the editorial board. And I knew if I got this one guy that so many other people thought positively of him, then I could very easily get a couple others. And if I had this couple others as well as him, I knew I could get the other people I wanted to get. And that's how I went about doing that, and I got the most fantastic. People have told me they thought it's the best editorial board for any journal they'd ever seen. And I think it's probably true. I had the best people in the world on this editorial board. Now, I said to Steve Jones, I said, Steve, listen, what you got to do is put together a first-class editorial board. And I said, what I think you ought to do is go to this spine, this organization that A.K. Dewdney had organized, which included a number of scientific experts and some engineers and mathematicians and stuff. I said, put it together from there. But he didn't follow my advice. He put people on his editorial board like Alex Flom, who's an intellectual property attorney. I mean, it was ridiculous. He wound up putting some of his buddies on the editorial board. Well, this is ridiculous. If you have an, you know, if you have referee, a peer review procedure involving a bunch of your buddies, it doesn't mean anything. So, I mean, I was very upset with him. I mean, this is the 9/11 Society I founded. He's my co-chair. He's founding this journal, and I'm giving him advice about how to do it, and he doesn't do it. In fact, you know, if you go in, onto 9/11 Scholars site and scroll down to that, the Science of 9/11, where I'm talking about Steve's paper, I go through Steve's paper and explain this, his second paper, not his first, the one where he talks about it might need 10 tons of thermite or thermate. I go through and explain it's not a publishable paper. It's got a lot of rubbish in it. It's not well organized. It's not well reasoned. It's not a publishable paper. But he touts it. You know, this is one of his great contributions to 9/11 research. And I say, well, this is just not right. So, you know, I point out that he doesn't have a proper conception of scientific method either.
Yeah.
I don't know how we can expect good work from somebody who is a scientist, but of what caliber?
So you think that maybe he was there to neutralize some of the
Well, I don't necessarily say that. I mean, you know, if we were to go into this more deeply, you know, you could. That's obviously an hypothesis and a set of alternative hypotheses. Steve may just not be a very good scientist. And, you know, Pons and Fleischmann, he did this work in relation to Pons and Fleischmann, who made these discoveries about cold fusion. And Steve's work was used to discredit their research. And when I was working on a discussion I was having in exchange with David Ray Griffin, who thought that Judy Morgan and I had somehow been too critical of the people in the Truth and Justice Society, when, in fact, I was pointing out to David Ray Griffin that they'd been monstrous, that people like this Victoria Ashley and Jim Hoffman had been launching all these accounts, you know, attacks on scholars and so forth that were really vicious, nasty, and unfounded. I did some research and turned out a quote from Fleischmann, who said that he just thought that Steve Jones wasn't equal to the task of doing research at the level that was required to explore adequately cold fusion. I never actually wrote that up, but I did discover it, and his opinion tends to coincide with my opinion. I just don't think Steve's a very good scientist.
So when it comes down to it, who stands to gain by it being an inside job?
Well, let me tell you more. Okay, we got started. Now, I was telling you about some of the financial motives, $2.3 trillion here, $4.4 billion there. Turns out that Larry Silverstein is a close personal friend of Benjamin Netanyahu, who, of course, is the extreme right-winger in the Israeli government. I wouldn't be surprised if the whole plan for 9/11 had originated in a conversation between Netanyahu and Silverstein. A couple of weeks after 9/11, Ariel Sharon was boasting that we own America and the Americans know it. Well, that's a very curious juxtaposition of 9/11 just a couple of weeks prior to Ariel Sharon boasting about owning America and the Americans know it. I mean, there appear to have been three overarching motives here. One was coveting the oil of the Middle East. Now, remember, Dick Cheney had that energy policy meeting at the start of the administration where he wouldn't even allow the names of those who were involved in the meeting. I think at that point he was bringing the big oil boys in to roughly place the powers of the American government at their disposal, and he asked for their wish list. And they said, well, you know, that Iraqi oil, that's really cheap to get out of the ground. Why don't you get us the Iraqi oil fields? And, of course, now they're, you know, contemplating attacking Iran, God knows. Let's hope it doesn't happen. But, I mean, these people are borderline insane, and it may well happen yet. So I think, you know, another was weakening, you know, any nation that might rival Israel for influence in the Middle East. Well, Iraq was the most sophisticated modern country in the Middle East. It had the highest level of education. It had a superb system of public education. It had a wonderful public health system. It had a whole lot of features. And, you know, Saddam ran it as a kind of socialized government. Well, you know, these people don't like socialism. They don't even like government. In fact, it's interesting that when a big group like Cheney and Bush come into government, they try to ensure it's going to fail. In fact, you know, they've been selling off the government. They've been trying to privatize all the functions. It's completely absurd, and it's disgusting, and it's going to, you know, take decades for the United States to regain a semblance of its former self after we get rid of these rogues and scoundrels. But the fact is, Israel had a great interest in weakening the political influence of any nation that could rival it, and of course, Iraq was the most omnipresent. So the Israeli wish list would include Iraq, Iran, Syria, you know. So what's the United States doing? It's going after Iraq, Iran, Syria, as though we're doing the bidding, as though the Israelis owned America, and we know it, just as Ariel Sharon said. Now, George Bush, too, claims to have studied history and to know that the great presidents were the war presidents. So George Bush came in wanting a war. In fact, Paul O'Neill, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury, said how he was astonished that at the very first cabinet meeting of the new Bush administration, so this would have been in January or February of 2001, that they were already discussing going to war with Iraq. So, of course, this was long before 9/11. Here's something else that gives you a nice illustration of what was at stake here. And of course, in the background, hovering in the background, is this neocon agenda of creating an empire greater than any the world has ever known. You have the demise of the Soviet Union, so the United States is the sole remaining superpower, or once was, I think, describing the U.S. now when it's bankrupt as a superpower, when we've lost our moral standing in the world, is a really silly description. But it's, you know, we're still powerful, but, you know, we're corrupt, and that corruption, I think, in the world is seen through. So here we have this business where there was negotiations were going on with the Taliban about the construction of a pipeline across the northern part of Afghanistan. And we told the Taliban that if they agreed to this construction, we'd bathe them in gold. If not, we'd bathe them in bombs. They didn't, and after 9/11, we did. And today, that pipeline is under construction. There are two permanent bases, ideally positioned to protect it. The president of Afghanistan is a former UNICAL oil official. Our ambassador to Afghanistan is another former UNICAL oil official. This is not rocket science.
Okay, and so I guess what we need to do is we kind of need to get a summation. Sounds like we could keep going on with this, but...
Well, the fact of the matter is that greed and money and power have motivated all of these events. It involved $2.3 trillion in relation to the Pentagon, and God knows where all that money went. $4.4 billion in New York City, and the demolition of, you couldn't bring those buildings down by conventional demolition because it would have released all the asbestos, so it couldn't be done legally. But it sure was convenient when those planes flew into those towers and they suddenly, poof, they were gone. It involved Bush being a war president. It involved Halliburton and the military-industrial complex wanting a war. Halliburton getting all these $100 billion no-bid contracts. Look how it's benefited, private outfits. We have this whole private army called Blackwater. I mean, a lot of people with powerful connections to Bush and Cheney are making a staggering amount of money out of all of this.
Which ties back to the PNEC documents?
Yeah, exactly. When I talk about the neocon agenda, I'm talking about the project for the new American century. That's exactly right, the outline of this plan to create, to go into the Middle East and create a center of power and project it outward while you create a string of bases around the world. Absolutely. So this is supposed to be the empire greater than any the world has ever seen. So, it really was a lot of crass motivation, and the American people are paying for it. The estimate for the price tag for the taxpayer is now estimated to be between $2 and $3 trillion when it's all said and done. This is the war, remember, we were assured was going to pay for itself. And of course, the actual estimates, if you study the Veterans Administration figures, the reports now that suggest that as many as 70,000 Americans have died in this war, not just 4,000, because they have changed the way of counting casualties. If you're not dead on the spot on the ground, if they actually get you into a helicopter or other mode of transportation, you die on the way to the hospital or in the hospital, you're not counted as a combat casualty. So I've been very clever about how they do this. I'm convinced somebody with philosophical background has been playing these games. It's like inventing the presence of Iraq in of Al-Qaeda in Iraq by defining an entity called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So, I mean, by definition, it's there, even if it might have one person who is actually Al-Qaeda. The whole thing is a fraud, greatest deception in American history, one of the real military calamities of all time. It will only be exceeded if we actually attack Iran, because then the whole world is going to turn against us in a way that, it will take generations to overcome.
Any closing comments, Eric?
Well, yeah, I think, obviously... Jim has hit the nail on the head. I would just add black operation and psychological operation to those terms, to the terms that he added. These were highly sophisticated and very high-tech military operations. And, of course, to start to comprehend that, realize that the government is doing high-tech, sophisticated black and psychological operations against the American people, this is not something people can easily grasp.
Eric, you're exactly right. I mean, terrorism involves instilling the population with fear through acts of violence or threats of acts of violence in order to manipulate them for political purposes. That's exactly the purpose of 9/11, which means that the American government has been practicing terrorism on the American people.
Well, I really want to thank you, Jim and Eric, for...
Thank you, Jim, again.
My pleasure.
Yes, I'd like to have you back in again here sometime.
I'd be glad to, Mel. You figure out when. I'd be glad to come back.
Okay, well, thank you.